Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we hear from writer and eco-activist Victoria White on how climate change action not only means everyone doing their bit, it requires a radical shift in policy too. If you're someone who enjoys a leisurely seashore walk combined with a little bit of fact-finding en route, the National Biodiversity Data Centre wants to hear from you. And archaeologist, historian and presenter of the landmark TV series Coast, Neil Oliver, shares his unique window on the world with Dr. Richard Collins.
The jagged edge of Cornwall jabs defiantly into the Atlantic. Only the most durable rock can resist that ocean's pounding. This tough coastline doesn't give up its treasures easily. But from the earliest times, men have been drawn here to pit themselves against the granite.
And what a beautiful series it is, too.
Here he is at last, the mystery man of India. Our first glimpse as the Rajputana came alongside at Marseille. And there's a woman of whom you've probably all read, but never seen in a picture. Miss Madeleine Slade, the English daughter of an admiral, who now prefers to be known as Malala Ben. And just behind her comes Mr. Gandhi, dressed as he said he would be, in just his loincloth, even in the chilly climes of Europe. And he's carrying with him his pots and pans, which he declared at the customs.
Mahatma Gandhi urged his supporters to be the change that you wish to see in the world. So when it comes to the environment, are people actually prepared to make the necessary lifestyle changes to combat climate change? And could collective green changes undertaken by individuals really be enough to make a difference? Freelance writer Victoria White, who's been living the greener lifestyle longer than most, believes it's going to take a whole lot more than that. Eanan Ilana recently met Victoria at her Dublin home.
I am here in the leafy suburbs of Milltown in the wonderful back garden that runs down to the Dodder. And the back garden belongs to Victoria White, who is here beside me with a large cup of coffee. How are you, Victoria?
Grand. All the better for the coffee.
So you're a freelance writer and a carer when you have four children and you have this wonderful garden.
Yes, I do. Yeah, lucky me. That's the essence of it. Yeah, bit of luck, that's all.
Yes, I know, and you really have it a most wonderful garden because it's a wild garden. It's not all manicured and every plant that is wanted, rudely described as a weed and vanished. You have all sorts of lovely plants here. But the garden is not as it seems. It seems a small enough garden here, the bit I'm in, but there's more to it, isn't there, Victoria?
Yes, there's this kind of a second. You go down a very steep, dangerous steps, and there's a second part of the garden which was originally a floodplain for the River Dodder, I think, and also this was a milling area, so it held also a mill race. And there was a mill race there when we came at the bottom of the garden, and lumps of iron from the old ironworks of the River Dodder. So there's a second bit of the garden that is reclaimed floodplain. Yeah, and it's even wilder. It's like a kind of a bonus garden. It's a kind of an additional secret garden, someone said the house should be called. And it's wild enough. And then you have a big, a wonderful big wall, 18th or 19th century wall, between one end of the garden, between one level of the garden and the other. And it's full of vegetation as well, full of ivy. And I mean, my garden's wild, you know. I mean, really, this is a wild space beside the river. Rather than a garden. And a lot of it was, you know, there was a very fond gardener here before me, the Roycroft family, and they planted the apple trees, and they were clearly people who just loved the environment. I always think the Roycroft name comes from West Cork, and there's a lot of Montbretia here in the garden, and really I feel that I'm in a little bit of, you know, the southwest kind of when I'm here.
And with fuchsia.
Yes, fuchsia and wild garlic that we brought from West Cork, further up in the other part of the garden, and it's a wonderful, you know, sort of snowdrifts of flowers in the early summer. So we use that in salads. It's great.
So it's certainly a green space, and it goes right there in the wall at the end, and then the River Dodder on the other side. Mm. So it's a really Rus and Urbis, isn't that what they call it?
Rural life. I mean, gosh, we sound like here where it's a property, you know, property porn, they like to call it. But I just had this vision. I suppose I grew up in a huge suburban garden with an old, bordered by an old wall near the sea in Blackrock. And I just had this desire to have a garden that bordered on a geographical feature rather than another person's garden. William Blake has a poem about walking through chartered streets, the chartered streets of London. And I felt that I was living in like a little shoebox in a chartered space. And it was the beautiful summers of the mid-2000s. I walked down the River Dodder and I looked to the back of houses and I thought, gosh, I'd love a space like that. I never thought I would ever be able to have one. But not everybody wants a big dishevelled space backing onto a river. And luckily they didn't, because we did. The house was in bad order. But it was September, there were blackberries, there were apples, there was the sun facing onto the trees, and I completely fell in love with it. I just wanted it, and that was it.
How long are you here now?
We're here 12 years.
And you never regretted it for a single day?
No, I love it. I mean, you know, because I work from home, my home environment is incredibly important to me. And really, when I'm looking back at my life, I realise that a very large part of the reason that I gave up my office job in the early 2000s as a newspaper person was because I couldn't stand the lack of natural light, and I couldn't stand the lack of access to nature. And I mean, that might sound terribly hippy-dippy and everything, but that's just me, you know. I mean, I grew up I grew up in an incredible garden because my mother was from rural Donegal. She kind of created that in a suburb of Blackrock. And so I just, at a certain age, I was gasping for green, gasping for natural light. And so that I have here. The guys have, you know, suburbs aren't particularly wonderful for teenagers, or, you know, I mean, they don't think it's just so fantastic that we have this. So, like, that's kind of a little bit, no, you know.
I suppose
not.
When you get too big to play in the garden, you want greener fields.
The one thing is that, as I said, there's two levels to the garden, so they can do an awful lot in the bottom level without us being able to see. And that is great, because kids nowadays, there are too many eyes on them too much of the time. So it gives them a space to play without my prying eyes. Yeah, and I work in the bottom garden as well, which is just an absolute privilege. The bird life that I see here, I see, like, when the apple blossoms come out, I see incredible bullfinches.
Yes, bullfinches. Yeah, great.
And, like, I never got them at home when I was growing up in Booterstown. And, like, my granny had a beautiful picture on a tile of apple blossom and bullfinch, and which I now have, and I see it constantly in front of me when I'm working, and it's wonderful. And I sent a picture of it to my sister who lives in Australia and said, you know, granny's picture is now in front of us. And she sent me a picture of lorikeets on a Granny Smith tree from Australia.
Pick your tree, pick your country. But I mean, speaking of Australia and speaking of here and speaking of climate change, how do you feel it's all panning out? Are we going to hell in a handcart? Is composting our tea bags and living a personal life that's free from sin, if you like, is this the way forward?
You know, it's not. I mean, of course it's not. I mean, I was very resistant to anybody looking at me and saying, what do you do personally in your personal life? I mean, I'm not going to sit in this stunning garden virtue signalling for Ireland. I'm not going to do that, because somebody living in a very small flat with no car in the inner city, whose house is freezing and who can't afford to heat it, has a much lower carbon footprint than I do. So, really, the thing is, we need system change. And it's a decade old, this business of, you know, I mean, the great thing was the Guardian editor said his car was greener than David Cameron's. That was, you know, the mid-2000s. And now look, David Cameron sprung Brexit on us, and the climate implications potentially of Brexit, for instance, you know. So, like, personal lifestyle choices, what they have to be mass changes, is they need to be affordable and they need to be practical. That's the thing. It needs to be easy. Like, why do I cycle everywhere? Well, I cycle everywhere because when I was a student, I didn't have money for the bus. Well, at least if I paid for the bus, I had no money for my half pints of Guinness. So, of course, I managed to get on my old Triumph 20 I'd had as a child, and I pedalled in for all I was worth. So I developed a habit. And now, why do I cycle? Well, I can't imagine not cycling, because it's the quickest, the easiest. I just don't know how people live when they don't cycle. I mean, and of course, it costs me nothing. So, yeah, I mean, am I trying to save the planet by cycling? Absolutely not. No, I'm just trying to get where I need to go in time.
So you think it's gone beyond a personal choice and that it has become a government choice. Big decisions have to be made. And you'd cycle more if there were more lanes to cycle on, for example. So therefore, what do you think of this terrible protest that's in some parts of Dublin whereby in order to make the cycle lanes and the bus lanes, we have to reduce people's front gardens and remove trees that are in their front gardens?
Well, we don't have to. We have to make a choice, and that's that the cars, there should be fewer cars. We have allowed the car to dominate. And remember that 30% of Dubliners don't have a car. It's not free to have a car. It's extremely expensive to have a car. So we've allowed somebody who, I mean, in very recent times would have been only somebody of a certain, you know, of a certain economic status to dominate the roads. And, you know, that's the problem. The problem is that the walker is first impacted, and then the cyclist is impacted, but the motorist can't be impacted. So ultimately we must save the trees, save the front gardens, and reduce the cars. Not that I have any problem with the cars. As I said, I have a car, I drive myself, but they're not fit for purpose in this inner Dublin, which it is.
In this medieval city, which was 1,000 years old, and other European cities have very little access by their cars, and people are able to survive there. So we need to change the emphasis, you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got to change the model, and the funding model has to change. Like, it has to be the 2-to-1 in favour of walking and cycling rather than cars. But instead, what we're doing is we're widening all the access roads to Dublin. And where are those cars going to go? They won't vanish, you know, once they get into the city. We've really got to change. We're one of the most congested cities in Europe.
1/5 of our emissions come from transport, but 1/3 of our emissions come from agriculture. Yeah. Now, how can we do this, seeing as how, I know this is an awful pun, but I'm going to make it anyway. It's the sacred cow, isn't it, of this. It can't be mentioned. What do you think? Can you mention it?
Absolutely. It is being mentioned now. I mean, everything's changed now, I think. One thing that really changed people was, I think, the Eat Lancet report that came out earlier in the year, which really said we've got to eat, you know, yes, we can eat a small amount of red meat. So it's not this kind of just something dangerous about this, which I hate. I hate that stuff. But like they say, eat that. It's a small meatball a day you can get away with for the planet, for your children's future and for your health. So I adopted the Eat Lancet diet in my home. Now, my kids, they might be eating nothing but chicken fillet rolls when they leave the house, and that's fine. But I do it in this house. So I'm thinking, we're talking here about consumption levels in the developed world of these products are going down because people know that it's not good for the planet, it's not good for their health, and they've access to other food. So really, what we need to do is The new cap, when it comes out, needs to, common agricultural policy, needs to change farming to take account of these new realities and consumer trends and also of the planet's health, rewarding farmers for being custodians of their land and custodians of carbon sinks rather than for producing beef, because it doesn't pay them anything to produce beef. They only gain subsidies from it.
Yes, certainly the common agricultural policy has very much influenced how people farm. I know certainly in the 80s there was all these grants to have sheep, and we had 8 million sheep in Ireland, and they ate the mountainsides bare.
Right.
Then the people got grants to get rid of the sheep, and they got rid of the sheep, and we're down to 3 million sheep now. So now the story is with the cattle. So, I mean, it's not really, in a way, whether people eat steak every day of the week or not. It's if it is not, if it's done at a higher level, that it makes it different, then that's the way to go, is it not?
Well, yes, but we need fewer cattle. And there's just no nice way of putting that. And all this business, I mean, of, you know, oh, well, our beef is the most, you know, carbon efficient. Now, it is in question. I mean, that is highly, not all reports find that to be the case. A recent UN report find it to be highly carbon intense, actually, our product. But you know, a spade, we have to call a spade a spade. We're in a situation of climate breakdown already. And we have been, in the last 5 years, we've imported fodder from abroad to feed our cattle because we haven't had the fodder in the ground to feed them. And I mean, this reminds me of, you know, the monocrop failure of the Great Famine and us trying to importing Indian meal. Like, our land was overstocked before the abolition of milk quotas. And you can't just keep on putting cattle on the land and expect the land to still pay you back. And I mean, yes, we've got to absolutely simply have a smaller national herd, and that's the fact. Farmers need to be properly paid. They're not being paid. We're creating high quality beef to make beef burgers. That's just ridiculous. The food producer should be getting far more of the benefit of a smaller amount of product.
The other big emitter of carbon into the atmosphere is energy creation. So a third from agriculture, a fifth from transport, and a fifth from energy, electricity, yeah, made from burning fossil fuels.
Yeah.
What do you? What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, like, we're meant to have a climate emergency as declared in the Dáil, and we're still making electricity with coal. And Moneypoint, which creates electricity with coal, was out of commission for, I think, nearly 3 months, and we survived. So, like, basically, if Minister Bruton was serious, like, tomorrow Moneypoint should be shut down. Clearly, you have to protect the livelihoods of the people involved. There's no question about that. Then the peat burning is going to go on until 2027. And really, what the hell is that about? I mean, you know, we are ripping up. That's when there won't be any left to burn. And it's like what we did with the blue whales. You know, we stopped hunting them when there were none. It always reminds me of that. Like, our bogs are vital carbon sinks, and we are stripping them in order to burn them to make electricity, you know. And I mean, we have to, like, there has to be system change that we see as an emergency. The people have heard an emergency declared in the Dáil. They need to see the emergency in action. And we have also full employment. This is the moment to do it. Those people who are engaged with the peat production, which, you know, which essentially earns us nothing as well, I have to say, divert the money into maintaining the livelihood of those people, and re-divert some of them, those who can or wish to, into retrofitting homes. Because our biggest problem now with insulation is that we don't have the tradespeople to actually put in the insulation. And some of them have similar skills to those who are employed by Bord na Mona.
So you don't advocate sitting at home and putting on an extra jumper? You do think it's a good idea to make your house a bit warmer?
Well, look, I'm not going to advocate for anyone to put on a jumper when I've got a heat pump and a beautifully insulated house. But and it's absolutely fantastic. And I wish...
How does a heat pump work now? We read about it in the paper all the time. But here you are with a heat pump.
Yeah.
You switch on a machine.
Well, do you know how your computer works? You know, I mean...
No. I know how to turn it on.
I know how to turn it.
When you come into your house and...
You do nothing.
What is it?
Okay, it's a thing that looks like an air conditioning unit. And the nice man put it in about a year and a half ago and turned it on, and that's it. I've had nothing to do with it since. So all I can do sometimes is I can alter the thermostat in the rooms, but it keeps everything at a consistent temperature. It's absolutely amazing. There's constant hot water, but I have solar for my hot water during the summer, and it talks to the solar, so it doesn't work to produce hot water when the solar is producing it. So I just do nothing, and I have incredibly low electricity bills.
Where does the heat pump get the heat from?
Well, there's a big question. Apparently, it's the same as a fridge, but the other way around. But I don't know how a fridge works. So it's apparently it uses the difference between the outside temperature and the inside temperature. But I mean, do we really know very much about how the things we have in our houses work?
I don't know how it works.
I just know it does work. It does work. But I mean,
no, this is not a leave and say question. And yeah, the reason why I'm asking you is because we hear so much about heat pumps all over the place, and nobody ever explains to anybody what a heat pump is.
Yeah.
People think, oh, is this going to be a great hole in the ground and getting geothermal?
It's literally the as I said. I mean, we got a contractor
ambient air in the room,
and he put a thing outside. It has to be outside, a thing that looks like an air conditioning unit outside, so it looks exactly like an air conditioning unit. It is exactly, it's very similar in what it is. And hooked it up to what was an old vestigial gas heating system, and that was it. I mean, did it in a day, and there was no impact of any type. And from then on, the house is always warm. It has to, your house has to be insulated, or else it's not economically viable. So our house was, the most important thing is insulation. But that's all very well, but we had the money to put up front, you know, and we knew a little bit about it, so that when we were doing big job on our house 10 years ago, insulation was the number one thing. And I mean, there are people, many, many people people did jobs then in the end of the Celtic Tiger with no insulation, and that's just an absolute crying shame. And so I really do applaud what's in the new climate plan, is that you won't be able to do a big retrofit without improving the BER and rating. And, you know, I mean, our BER rating is really good in this house. I mean, it was an absolute shell, I mean, in terms of it had no BER rating, really, and now it's a B1.
Yeah, which shows that it does work, and this thing, and presumably it works on electricity.
But not very much. But now, look, I mean, it will pay you back. But here's the thing: most people don't have money to put up front, and I mean, it was very tough for us as well, I have to say. But we found it. And the thing is, some people don't have access to credit. And so what you need to do is you need to front load the savings for individuals in order to make that system change. Maybe start with public housing and just go at it, you know. Go at it seriously here, you know.
Would you like to be the minister?
No, definitely not. I'd hate to be the minister. I don't want to be anywhere but in this garden.
speaking of this garden, coming back to basics, you know, when I come to visit people like yourselves, I'm always amazed at the wonderful things they're growing to eat. What do you grow to eat?
Well, you know, I don't do very much, I have to say, but I have fruit, I have lettuce, and I have herbs. They're my main things, because they're the most valuable things to grow in your garden, because they're the things you need to tend the whole time. They're the things that are expensive and that are hard to transport. So those are the worthwhile things, because we're living in a situation where, you know, carrots, you know, are very, very cheap. I'm sorry. They're, you know, it's not good, but it's true. I'm feeding four children. So what I have here is I have apples from the previous owner and some of my own. So I have two fabulous old Bramleys, and I have, and they last me the whole way. I do my Christmas puddings, everything, the whole way. I store them in the back garden on old apple stores they used to have, and they do me the whole year. And then I have eaters, and I have too many. I have to get them thinned. And then I have plums, and I have pears, and I have gooseberries, and I have red currants, white currants, blackberries.
And are these pears?
No, they're pears. I'm surprised at you.
No, they're
blackberries.
The ones above.
Cherries. I've never eaten the cherries. I have loads of raspberries, strawberries, loads of herbs of every type and denomination, and I have lettuce, of course, and salads. I mix salads. Now, I've bought Rocket loads of times and continually losing the packet. But normally I have lots of Rocket, lots of lettuce, and I love that. And as I said, I grew up in a garden where, you know, I walked out in the morning with my cornflakes bowl, and I put the raspberries on it. And my mother made bucket loads of jam, and I grew up with, you know, fresh potatoes out of the ground, boiled in mint. My mother would say, go out and get some mint, and then the whole house would be full of mint. And, you know, I grew up with going to cut lettuce, you know, in the summer. So I have this sense of summer abundance, and there's too much then for us to eat. But I like that, because that continually makes me, stimulates me to invite people to the house, you know, to sit outside and eat
and
the
share,
fruit.
Share the lettuce. Share
it. I love it. I mean, we all had our family had birthdays in the summer, and it was all about strawberries and raspberries and sitting outside and meringues. I finally cracked the meringue, meringue barrier. 10 years after my mother's dead, she's finally let me take her place as a meringue maker. And you know, sponges. I mean, all that stuff. The glory of an Irish summer. I adore it. I mean, I hate the winter. I hate the darkness of the winter, but I glory in this now. You know, it's gorgeous.
And you have the memory then of the associated food and the garden and the whole
nature. It's laid down early, so this is how important it is, I guess. I mean, you know, my kids scorn all this stuff, but like, I mean, it'll come back eventually. You know, that's the truth of it. It's the connection. I mean, food is how we engage with the environment in the most profound way. So it's actually to do with understanding the taste, the smells, the textures, the culture. And that's all to do with respect for the environment. It's interesting. Someone said to me recently, the word Eucharist is the same word, Efcharisto, which is in Greek, thank you. So basically, it's a thank you. To sit down at a meal together with people is a thank you for the fruits of the earth.
We have a wonderful, wonderfully appalling relationship with food generally in Ireland. Let's have our dinner now quick and get it over with. And the whole social thing about eating in company, that's completely gone in Ireland.
I agree with you, but I mean, this is where the business of climate change, you have to look at much, much wider things. You have to look at our focus on productivity. And I mean, what we need is more respect for recreation, leisure, for home-based work, for unpaid work, for the other side, the dark side of the moon, of the economy. And that is the least carbon intense side of the moon. And our entire focus is on just GDP or whatever as a that's no measure of well-being whatsoever. So we have to move to that in order to become a climate resilient society, I think.
So when the revolution comes, you'll be in the vanguard.
I know, probably I'll be in my garden.
Thank you very much, Victoria, for talking to me.
Freelance writer Victoria White speaking with Aina Nilauna, during which she referred to Richard Bruton, Minister for Communications, Climate Action and Environment. Aina Nilauna interviewed the minister recently and they spoke about the issue of energy generation.
I can tell you something to do immediately that will sort out 49% of emissions from electricity, and that is to close down Money Point this minute and close down the two peat burning stations. 49% of our emissions from electricity generation comes from burning coal and turf, and it's crackers. We're burning those turf stations, and they could be closed down in the morning. People work there, I'd realise that. They would have to be re-employed, they would have to be looked after. I'm not saying don't do that, but once the turf is gone, it's gone. It's a carbon source, it's a carbon sink, it's totally inefficient way of making electricity, it's causing pollution in the air. You, as the minister, with a stroke of a pen, could close those down tomorrow. Why don't you?
Well, we have committed to close them down in a phased basis.
In 2027, more Amshire Oshinok. Why not now?
Because every day we need power, and whether it's power to drive our businesses, our farms, our homes, we need that power.
Money Point was closed down for three months.
But Money Point was... You've all the answers yourself, so well, work away.
Yeah. Money Point was closed down for a couple of months in the winter and the grid didn't go down. I'm just saying.
Yeah, but you have to, when the wind doesn't blow, as in, say, a cold winter's day, the wind doesn't blow and you have everyone want to turn on their heat, what do you do then?
Well, you have backups with gas, yes. which is a less significant one. Not coal and peat, I'm saying.
So where do you get those gas stations?
Well, we have gas stations already. Our Dublin one is gas.
So, in other words, if you're going to take out some major part of your generation, like Money Point, you have to make sure that you're still in a position to deliver power to the people who need it. So you have to build up your alternatives. We have to build up our renewable capacity to make sure that we have alternatives. So that's why we'll need more wind farms coming on to meet the rising demand. We will take coal and peat out of the system and we'll have to replace them with other fallbacks, and they will include new gas stations which can come in at very short notice. We will also have to start looking in the longer term at new storage, a bit like Thurlock Hill, new options. But those are all big changes that we have to take time to invest. You can't, you know, turn a switch. The same as in transport. You can't say, you know, we're now 97% dependent on fossil fuels. Why isn't everyone driving electric cars? You have to do this over stages because an electric car is more expensive. You have to make sure that people can afford it. So you have to do a plan. And that's really what this is. This is a 10-year plan. There aren't silver bullets in this sphere. You know, there aren't easy, painless solutions like you're suggesting. You know, switch off Money Point and the job is up. So you just have to plan to make sure that, you know, the lights will still be on, people will still be able to go about their daily lives. And that's really important. You know, energy security to sustain the standard of living that we enjoy is really important.
Richard Bruton, Minister for Communications, Climate Action and Environment, speaking with Aina Nilauna, and you can hear the extended interview on next week's show. Now, the chances are that you caught sight of our next guest on your TV screens. He frequently appears, as one British newspaper puts it, staring out to sea, his luscious hair streaming in the wind like a Scottish Paul Dark. Archaeologist, historian, author and presenter Neil Oliver has presented some of the BBC's biggest landmark TV series, such as Coast, Vikings and A History of Scotland, vividly bringing ancient worlds back to life. The people, history and geography always inextricably intertwined with nature.
Constructing a property on an island with only limited access to the mainland would present builders with a few headaches, even today. But imagine trying to build a house 14 miles out at sea, 300 years ago. A house that would be responsible for saving thousands of lives.
Neil Oliver is undoubtedly a man with itchy feet during his hugely popular TV series. He's lapped the coast of Britain and Ireland more times than he can remember, as well as venturing further afield to Scandinavia, France, North America, Australia and New Zealand. But as the saying goes, home is where the heart is, especially for this Renfrew-born man who's now president of Scotland's National Trust. On a recent visit to Ireland, when he was speaking at the Imrama Festival of Travel Writing in Lismore, County Waterford, Neil stopped off and joined Richard Collins for a brief, wet and windy walk along Dublin's coast.
Neil, I couldn't resist the temptation to bring you to Howth, because this wonderful harbour here was created by a Scottish engineer, John Rennie, if you please imagine that. And the harbour on the far side, the rival harbour, the far side of Dublin, Dunleary, was also his work. So you were in a kind of a Scottish enclave or promontory from home. You were famous on our screens, of course, for many things. A history of the Celts, for instance, and Coast, of course. And this programme, Coast, is extraordinary. You began life as an archaeologist, is that right?
I did. I studied for a degree in archaeology at Glasgow University in the mid-80s. And then life took me on a strange and unexpected path. I retrained as a newspaper reporter. I worked as an internet journalist, and then accidentally stumbled into television in my early 30s. And then Coast came along. It was a happy accident, but it was a wonderful accident. It put me aboard a magic carpet, really, that then carried me on a journey, a bespoke tour of the islands of Britain and Ireland. I've seen so many places that even locals would not have visited. You bringing me here, telling me something that I don't know about, the fact that this is the work of a Scottish engineer, that is, in the best possible sense, the story of my coast life. We were very much in the role of learning things on behalf of the viewers. We weren't supposed to be experts. We weren't supposed to be any kinds of know-it-alls. We would turn up, we would meet interesting people and hear and learn just moments before the viewers did. And I think that was part of what made the programme attractive, because it gave it a kind of immediacy. And then we'd be discovering something about local wildlife, local plant life, whales, seals, seabirds. It was a constantly changing and evolving cornucopia, which made it fascinating. And I think that was why it lasted for 10 years. It was so popular with viewers, because it was constantly refreshing itself, much like the sea does.
So you're a kind of polymath, a kind of Renaissance man of modern archaeology, science and history.
I wouldn't make any such claim. I was in the very privileged position of constantly being exposed to people who were. I've had a unique experience of learning from, listening to and acquiring some scraps of knowledge from experts all the way along the line, which has given me a very strange collection of information that now rattles around inside my head.
Well, now, when you look back at that long series, 10 years, you say, are there particular ones that stand out? What comes into your mind? What is the most life-changing interview you did or experience you had on that? Or is that too difficult a question?
Life-changing is difficult. I can honestly say, I mean, here I've been around and around the island of Ireland many times, the North and the Republic. And I do remember feeling very strongly that I had never experienced the Atlantic Ocean anything like as powerfully as I did when I was on the western coast of the Aran Islands. Mm-hmm. You know, to stand on the western coast of Inishmore and look out at that muscle of the Atlantic when it's coming in, the waves having not struck land for whatever it is, 2,500 miles since North America, the Atlantic only looks like that in one place, and it's right there. So I was very struck by the west coast of Ireland, Galway, Aran Islands. But in terms of life-changing experiences, the whole thing was a life-changing experience. It was just an enormous privilege to see so many places. It's why I wrote the book. I'm here at the Imrama Festival because I'm talking about a book I published last year called The Story of the British Isles in 100 Places. I know that the use of the word British there is controversial, but it's a cartographer's convention to name an archipelago after the largest landmass. But there are stories about, there are Irish stories there as well as stories from every other country in the archipelago, these islands. And I feel as if I've just been given a unique tour. And I can honestly say that the experience of doing the kind of work that I've done has blurred national boundaries for me. Time and time again, we crossed boundaries between Ireland and Northern Ireland, between England and Wales, England and Scotland. And going round and around and around, I lost track of national boundaries and national identities, and the whole place became one archipelago with which I fell in love. And I regard myself as being a citizen of the whole place. You know, I'm standing here, in the outskirts of Dublin, and I feel as much a sense of, fondness, love, responsibility for this landscape as I do for landscapes back home in Scotland or in England or in Wales. I feel a sense of belonging to the whole place.
So these boundaries are really only in the mind. If you're interested in nature or ecology, you don't think in these terms. I never sort of think at all about boundaries, political boundaries. They don't mean anything. I remember your programme, Orkney, the capital of Britain or something
yes.
like that. Now, in that, you linked very much the Irish megalithic remains with those of Scotland. And I presented a kind of unified view of things. You seem to have got the impression that Newgrange was a sort of central location from which the others sprung out. Would you outline a bit of that for us?
Yes. Newgrange and Nowth are dated to, I think, 3,200. They're older than the pyramids. Mm-hmm. They're amongst the oldest architecture of their kind anywhere. Mm-hmm. And clearly there was a cosmology, a way of understanding life and the universe and everything that surrounds it that inspired people to circular creations. And, you know, and obviously Newgrange and others of those mounds are circular. They functioned as much more than burial places. They were probably much more akin to the idea of a cathedral. You know, you don't just go to a church because of death. You go for many... Through the cycle of the year, you go for births and you go for marriages, and there are other celebrations besides. And those buildings, those structures, probably functioned in similar ways, encyclopedic ways. And yes, there are similarities across the board. You know, there was obviously contact between Ireland and the Long Island of the United Kingdom. Architects are obviously moving between them. There's no doubt about it that there was commonality. And if you could call it a religion, or perhaps it was a science, that people understood it right across this archipelago. I have had so many experiences, though, around the Irish island. I was hugely affected by a few stories that I did across the course of just a few days, where I learned about the Angorta Mór, I think it's described, the Great Hunger, and also the fact that not only had there been the Great Hunger, there was slavery, that a place like Baltimore was hollowed out by Barbary pirates. And those slavery and starvation, those are maladies of humankind that we associate with, say, Africa in the modern era. And I found it enormously affecting to realise that here people were affected by exactly the same curses. And then later the same day, I went out in a towel sail yawl, this beautifully refurbished wooden vessel, and we sailed out to Fastnet, to the teardrop of Ireland. And I was so moved by the fact that you don't have to travel too far. You don't have to take too great a journey to experience so much of the human condition. You know, who would have thought that you could go to one corner of a relatively small island like Ireland and see the curses of famine and starvation and disease and slavery, and then the grief of the emigrants, those that had no option, they felt, but to leave this homeland and go elsewhere. And it was all, you know, in a patch of ground that I covered in the course of a couple of days. And it was I've remembered that week ever since.
Of course, we think of M1s and M6s and all, and M25s and M50s and all this sort of thing, because we think that's the way one travels. But of course, back in the time of the Neolithic people, it was the sea and rivers that connected people. And of course, back then, Newgrange is not all that far from Orkney, say. when you go by sea. If you had to go by land, it's something else. So in a sense, it's not surprising that you have the Cage of Fields right on the coast, and you have the Boyne Valley, Tumuli and so forth, and you have all the wonderful megalithic remains in Scotland, and indeed down in France, Karnak, and some in Spain even. So there's a kind of link all the way from Africa, really, North Africa, all the way up to the north of Scotland. So in a funny sort of way, the map you must have in your head, a map of ancient times, is rather different, you know, from what you would find if you bought a map out of the shop.
You know, we've touched already on this experience I've had where modern, modern national boundaries blur. And I think it's not just an experience that only I would have. I think anyone who travels around the way I have, and I think perhaps the way you have, you lose track of where you are in relation to modern distinctions. It becomes a landscape. And yes, there are divisions and there are lines, but they're not those lines. Or there are other lines that are older and that tell a different story. The Cage of Fields that you mentioned, that was an extraordinary story. That was a farmer called Patrick Caulfield discovered a piece of dressed stone while doing some or other work on some of his land, thought nothing more about it, and then it was his son Seamus who became the archaeologist who then persevered and has mapped mile upon mile of cattle enclosure that Neolithic farmers had built, some kind of massive community collective effort to create this whole a landscape shape for looking after cattle. Fuels to keep cows separate from bulls, cows and calves separate from the rest of the herd. You know, they were managing livestock on a grand scale, and all of that revealed by the efforts of one man until relatively recent times. So you have to come to somewhere like the Cage of Fields to see something that was presumably the case right across the landscape, and in Scotland, and in England, and we've lost it there because of, you know, more modern development. But that little glimpse that you get in the Cage of Fields would probably have just been a stand-in for what would have been normal in the rest of the landscape.
And I'm sure you drove a pole into the ground, and it touched a stone a few metres down.
It's magical. It's a
and
magical
that
feeling.
Was not touched by anyone for 5,000 years.
And the fact that it's an iron rod, and you push them, you know, feet down. I mean, the blanket bog there is anything up to 15 feet thick, and you push down, and then you hear this. It's like ringing a bell. You hear this ting, 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 ting of the iron on the stone, and you think, you know, you're making that stone speak. That has been silent and asleep under the blanket bog for thousands of years, and it's a magical experience.
And I remember you describing somewhere, or maybe you wrote it, holding a tool of a Stone Age man in your hand and thinking, well, the last person who held this died millions ago, and how you there's a connection with them. He's same as you biologically.
I think it's unavoidable to feel that sense of connection. There's a wonderful a mace head that came out of the burial mound at Nowth. It's about the size of a man's clenched fist, and the way it's been worked, it's a piece of Orkney flint actually, but by some or other path it has found its way to that part of Ireland, and it's been worked beautifully so that when you look at it, it looks like a face. It's like two eyes and a mouth wide open, and the shaft of the handle would have fitted into what is effectively the gaping maw of this stylized face. And you, I've held it in my hand, and you have to wonder at the, you know, that you're holding a work of art. And other people have held it, but not so many in the intervening millennia. But you're making some sort of connection with someone who sat and looked at a beach pebble and thought, what can I make of that? And their artistic genius and their energies went into it and transformed it into what you're now holding in your hand. And it's impossible to avoid, I think, feeling some sort of connection to that person across the abyss of time.
So, Neil, you are a man in passage. Everywhere you're going somewhere, and mentally and physically, and I think spiritually even, you are going places all the time. Hopefully you will come back to Ireland one day, and you will be a changed man even then from what you are now.
I expect always to be back. I travel, I go back to places repeatedly. I've lost track now of how many times I've been on Orkney. I've lost track of how many times I've been on Shetland. I've lost track of how many times times I've been in Cornwall or Cambridgeshire or of how many times I've been in the Welsh Valleys, how many times I've been in Northern Ireland, how many times I've been in the Republic of Ireland. And I'm always thinking, well, when I leave, every time I think, well, I'll be back.
Neil, it's been fascinating talking to you, and thank you very much indeed.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard Collins and Neil Oliver. Now, looking out across the sweeping bay, there's a spectacular view of North Bull Island with its mud, marshes and sandy shores. This UNESCO Biosphere Reserve is a haven for wildlife, including millions of shellfish, flocks of migratory birds and cetaceans regularly can be seen from the shore. Now, for anyone listening who enjoys seashore walks and observing wildlife along the way, then perhaps this could be something that would interest you. Members of the public are being asked to take note of different species of flora and fauna while they're out and about along the coast and provide key information about their findings to the National Biodiversity Data Centre. Recently, the Explore Your Shore workshop took place in the Interpretive Centre on North Bull Island, raising awareness of the vast biodiversity on our shores, but also encouraging people to take part in this latest project. Dave Wall, Citizen Science Officer with the NBDC, was presenting the workshop, and our reporter Terry Flanagan took a stroll with him along the island shore.
Oh, Terry, have a look at this one here. It's an interesting one, a shell you don't see every day, but you find
I don't know that shell.
Yeah, it's quite a big one, quite heavy as well, very thick shell. It's actually the ocean quahog, or the slight Icelandic cyprine. And it's the world's oldest known species. The oldest animal, the oldest Icelandic cyprine ever found was 507 years old, would you believe? They have a very exciting life. They sit in the seabed, filtering water, and growing extremely slowly. They're a northern species, really.
Can I just hold it there?
Yeah.
Oh, it's quite... It is quite heavy too, isn't it?
Yeah, we're getting towards the southern edge of its range here, really. It's a cold water species. But, like I say, very slow growing, and they grow thick, hard shells, so they survive quite well. And actually, a friend of mine was walking down the beach here. We're here in Dollymount Strand. He found an alive one, actually washed up on the shore. Oh, yeah. So he did his duty and flung it back into the sea. But
now, why are we down here today?
Well, we're here today. We've just had a stakeholder workshop for Explore Your Shore. So it's the official launch of Explore Your Shore, which is a new citizen science initiative funded by the EPA.
Now, will you start off and explain citizen science? Because a lot of people come to me and say, I don't understand what citizen science is.
So citizen science is really getting the public to get involved in collecting data, collecting useful data we can then use. In this case, it's biodiversity data we can use to create biodiversity maps and to interpret whether these species are of use as bioindicators of climate change and water quality. But basically getting the public to both provide us with coverage, because there's far more members of the public than there are scientists, and also makes it more affordable. Citizen science isn't free, but it's certainly a lot cheaper than, let's say, hiring contractors to collect the same information.
And, of course, with the advance of technology, the advance particularly of mobile phones and good quality cameras, you know what you're getting is real.
That's the real difference with citizen science today versus when I started in citizen science 20 years ago, is the fact that everybody now has a phone in their pocket and has a camera on that phone. So now we don't just get the record of where the person was, what they saw, we also get usually a really good quality image of what it was they found.
Now, looking here on the beach as well, that's a mermaid's purse there, am I right?
It is, yeah. So mermaid's purses are, of course, the egg cases of sharks and skates and rays.
Yeah.
In this case, it's a spotted ray, and these are very commonly found along the shore here. So this would be laid by the ray down in amongst the seaweed on the seabed. And the next winter storms, by this stage, the little baby ray is hatched out and swam off to hopefully have a long life.
So that's just the empty case, isn't it?
That's just the empty case. It's made of the same stuff as your fingernails, a kind of keratin. But it's the little home that the baby ray grows up in. And in the winter storms, they wash ashore and then they blow up into the dunes, and that's where we find them.
Okay, explain a little bit more then about Explore Your Shore.
So Explore Your Shore, really, the big driver behind this is, at the moment in the National Biodiversity Data Centre data sets, we've very few marine records. We've a very good repository of terrestrial records. Of course, we always need more. But on the marine side, we're struggling because there's not a strong record of the public, I suppose, recording marine and especially intertidal species here in Ireland.
And why do you think that is?
I mean, it's not because people aren't down at the beach. They are. We know there's people using the coast every day of the week. I suppose it's just habit. It's awareness of the need to record intertidal biodiversity. I'll give you an example. This beadlet anemone, which is an incredibly common little creature found on
beautiful
rocky
colour.
Shores. Mm. Beautiful red colour. Really common. You'll find on every rocky shore around the country. We only have 400 records of it.
Yeah.
Foxes in general, we've 11,000 records, and foxes aren't that easy to spot because they're largely nocturnal.
Well, is it a case then that people are more familiar with animals and plants that would be grown, say, on the side of the road, in a hedgerow, in a ditch?
That's definitely part of it as well. People struggle perhaps to identify even fairly common marine species, and that's also part of what we're doing here. We're raising awareness of the species that are out there. We want people to become more familiar with our coastal species. We literally want people to go and explore your shore, find out what's there. With the aid of the website and our resources and the surveys we have online, to learn about your shore and learn about the biodiversity that's there.
So what can the public do?
Public can log on. Basically, everything you need to know to get involved in the project is on our website, which is exploreyourshore.ie. People log on there. At the moment, we've two surveys up and running. That's Seashore Spotter, which basically enables you to, wherever you are around the coast, you take a picture of, let's say, a beadlet anemone, you add in the information of where you saw it and when, and you submit that to us, and that becomes a record there in due course. The other part of the survey we have up and running at the moment is the Big Beach Biodiversity Survey, and that's quite a nice one as well. We just trialled it here today. Basically, you spend at least 30 minutes on your local beach walking the strand line and recording as many different shell species. We're really looking for bivalve records as we're doing that survey, but also
I'm just
any of the
at
other
one here, the razor shell.
Exactly, yeah. Here's a razor shell, for example. So this is a pod razor, which is probably the commonest razor shell you find on the shore here. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a big one, you know. And these are named after the old cutthroat razors
that
your granddad would have used for shaving the beard. Basically, we're asking people to record as many bivalve species as possible, but also a whole plethora of other flotsam and jetsam that washes in with the tide, which could include seaweeds such as the wracks, the egg wracks, the bubble wrack, and also little strange little things like this, which looks like a seaweed but isn't. This is an animal. This is hornwrack, which is a bryozoan, which is a colonial multicell animal.
It is very like a wrack. It's like blather wrack, only a much smaller version.
It is. It's very dainty looking, actually. Yeah. And most people do think it's a seaweed, but it's actually lots of single-celled animals grouped together.
And if I look down the shore there, I can see two of what we would consider Dublin's most favourite shells there, the cockles and the mussels.
The cockles and the mussels, that's it. So here we have the blue mussel, which is the common one that most people would recognise from eating their dinner. If you're sitting in a restaurant eating mussels, this is the one you're eating. And also the common cockle again, which is
very pretty, isn't it?
It is a pretty little shell, you know, and they get to quite a size as well. We also have this one over here, which I just noticed here, which is the prickly cockle, which is kind of the bigger cousin of the common cockle.
Yeah.
And you can see these little spines on it.
And who exactly are you looking for in the public?
Anyone and everyone, really. Anyone can do this survey, and people shouldn't be afraid of trying it. It's particularly suited as well to school groups and educational groups, because they can go out and they might be doing something on the intertidal anyway, but they can collect this data, submit it to the Biodiversity Data Centre, and see their data mapped and put into use.
Yeah.
So it's a really good one to get the kids interested and inspired in collecting biodiversity data.
And say after a storm, that'd be a particularly good time to come down, wouldn't it?
It would, and that's one of the interesting things about the beach is it's not static, it's ever changing. People say, oh, how often should I survey? And I say, well, you can survey literally as many times as you like, because from month to month throughout the year, things will change on the beach. You'll get storms washing up species and a whole plethora of other things that you won't have seen before, because they'll wash in on the storm tide. And also seasonality in the waters adjacent to the beach here means that different species are prevalent at different times of year. So you're going to find different things washed up on the shore from month to month.
And even some large things, like maybe small sharks.
Small sharks, I mean big whales. We've had it, pretty much everything has washed up at Dollymount at some stage or other.
And just get out there, do your recording, and then put it online.
That's it. And through our Citizen Science portal, you'll be able to see all your data mapped and explore your own data over a time period. So the more data you collect, the more you get to play with.
And more information on how you can become a citizen scientist can be found on our website, rte.ie Mooney. That's all we have time for today. On sound was Sheila Neveal. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is Sinead Renshaw. And the producer is Sheila O'Callaghan. Until next time, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney.